they actually had a panel of 15 donors, real donors, from different public radio stations. I think about half of them were sustainers, and every single one of them said, I feel like you guys ignore me. I think it has to do with antiquated ideas about why we have these drives. I think it's volunteer focus. Oh, it's a time when we can all get together and we can all pitch in and pick up a shovel. That's not why you have a fun drive. You have a fun drive to raise money. Your capacity needs to drive your vision. And if you don't have the capacity, then, you know, then your vision is incredibly stunted.
On this edition of Radio Survivor, How to Fix Your Fundraising, a report back from Ann Alquist at the Public Radio Program Directors Conference.
Jennifer Waits tells us about the FCC's final decision about KUSF.
And did disco kill New York's top AM station? Matthew Lassar reports. I'm Eric Klein. I'm a host and producer of this radio program.
I'm Paul Riesmanel, and I'm another host and producer of this radio program. And thank you very much for choosing to spend a little bit of your precious time with us. We really do appreciate it.
And we'll make it worth your while. We have
will.
A nice show today.
I think there's a lot to learn. Ann Alquist, who is a co-executive director of KDHX Community Radio in St. Louis, Missouri, will be joining us. She is finishing up at the Public Radio Program Directors Conference in beautiful Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She'll tell us more about what that conference is, so we don't have to explain it to you. But Anne has written for Radio Survivor, the website, on several occasions, and she always has some fresh and provocative ideas, and she does not disappoint us right. In this episode.
Well, and you know, those program directors at public radio, they're managers at radio stations, and they're dealing with a lot of change and a lot of challenges. And Anne has some opinions based on her experiences to cut right through those anxieties and fears. And I think that's one of the reasons that it was fun to talk to her.
Well, let's go to that interview right now. We talked to Anne while she was in the lobby of the historic Omni William Penn Hotel in Pittsburgh, where the Public Radio Program Directors Conference was held. And she started off by explaining to us what exactly the conference is and why she was there.
And it's definitely focused on mid-sized to large NPR affiliates. But it also has now expanded to include what they're calling AAA or music discovery stations. And so I'm one of the co-directors at KDHX in St. Louis, Missouri, which is a community radio station, but we've also embraced the moniker of music discovery. And so that's one of the reasons why we felt as though it would be important for us to be here to meet with our peers in the non-commercial radio spectrum, because PRPD is beginning to build out its outreach to music discovery stations. And one of the reasons that they're doing that is because the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is sinking quite a bit of money into ViewHouse, which is a music video production enterprise to curate and collect music videos from lots of different music discovery / AAA public radio stations around the country. And so when CPB is investing in a lot of things, a lot of, especially music discovery stations, show up here that ordinarily wouldn't show up here, which is why I'm representing KDHX here. And they also invited me to talk on a panel.
What is a music discovery station? Can you explain that quickly?
We even had a breakout format session. So the news format people got together, the classical music people got together, and the AAA / music discovery stations got together. I think we spent about half an hour talking about what we should call ourselves, because we didn't really like AAA, because we didn't feel like it encompassed really the diversity of all the different music stations that are in the public radio landscape. And we didn't come to any consensus, so I'm just going to tell you what I think music discovery means. I think it means providing a serendipitous experience over the air or online or through our social platforms for our audiences to discover either new music or music that's, you know, that's from the past that can connect people to their musical heritage or another person's musical heritage.
And what kind of music are we talking about typically? Are we talking about indie rock, jazz, classical?
I think it's probably a lot of indie rock on the like the stations like The Current in Minnesota or KXT, which is the sort of the newest member of the Music Discovery family in Dallas. It's definitely more indie rock stuff. I mean, one of the reasons why I think stations are interested in talking to KDHX is because we have more diversity reflected in our program schedule. And so we have a lot more diverse acts coming through our station and recording in our studios. So KDHX has, you know, roots, Americana, hip hop, indie rock, rock. It's a much broader mix. I mean, that being said, I mean, I've listened to a lot of AAA-ish music discovery stations on the public radio spectrum, and they're kind of known for, you know, throwing in, you know, Ella Fitzgerald with, you know, Calexico or something.
Right. And so what was the panel that you were on?
Program directors can drive revenue to events as fundraisers. So I was there to talk about how we're trying to figure out non-traditional sources of revenue besides membership drives at our stations, because of course that's the business model for community and public radio, which is, you know, we go on the air, we ask for money, and some people give. So I was there to talk about how KDHX is the ways in which we're exploring how to generate revenue through our events.
And can you detail one or two of those ways? I'm sure people would love to hear that.
Well, just to kind of give you a sense, if I have a level of cynicism about events as fundraisers, the title of my presentation was Searching for Thunder Lizards. I think it's an elusive animal. Public radio is very taken at the moment with the Texas Tribune, and I don't know how familiar you are with their business model or their revenue generation model, but it relies heavily on events. Their events are free. To me, what the Texas Tribune is doing, they're doing with events what public radio already does over the airwaves. I mean, we give away our programming for free, and then we hit up donors, you know, to say, hey, you know, we gotta keep the lights on, you know, we gotta pay the engineer, you know, give us $60 for the year or whatever. And that's essentially what the Texas Tribune is doing. They're just not doing it over the air. They're just doing it with events. In terms of, I'm a little, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's what I told the audience at the panel session I presented at, which was, don't underrate this. This is our economic engine. Our membership drives still work. We just raised $250,000 at KDHX. It was the biggest fund drive in the history of the station.
Wow.
My focus, and it depends on the station. It depends on where the station is at in its scale and the size of its budget. Right now, KDHX is in a place where we very much need to grow our major donor base. We are going to do that with exclusive events. We had Heartless Bastards in our venue, and that was a great opportunity to invite major donors or prospective major donors so that we can bring them up this ladder of donations and to increase their gift. If we can demonstrate, you know, the value of being a major donor and provide this exclusivity, I mean, the goal is to increase our major gifts by $250,000, you know, in the next year. That's $250,000 gifts, just to kind of break it down. But that's where KDHX needs to be. That's going to be the rocket fuel that generates the operating capital so that, you know, KDHX has a strong future.
That sounds like something pulled from like a public radio playbook or even a lot of other sort of large nonprofits, not so much from community radio. Do you think, or are you finding any other community radio stations and people open to those sorts of things?
I don't think community radio has been very good at cultivating major donors. They're always sort of happy accidents. You know, oh, so-and-so left us $25,000 in their life insurance policy. I think they're so caught up in the day-to-day, I don't think they plan the strategy. And, you know, you get what you pay for. Most community stations can't really afford a person with the experience to really think and know about what works. We know that people want exclusive, unique experiences, and they're willing to invest in that. They're willing to support places that are able to provide that. And you're right. That is, that's not even out of a, that's not even a page out of a public radio playbook. That's just, that's a page out of any non-for-profit, non-commercial organization's playbook. You have to demonstrate your value to your significant donors.
And do you think that there's any sort of, we might even call it ideological objection to that in community radio, since that exclusivity for some may rub them the wrong way when they think about the inclusivity that community radio represents for them?
Yeah, that's sure. I've heard that. I mean, I've even heard that at KDHX. Those people are in the minority. I mean, the thing that I would also say to those people, you know, we're never going to turn down the $35 a year people. I had that. I used to run the membership department at Alaska Public Media. I mean, and there was a lady who came in twice a year during the radio drive. She came in with her check. You know, we're never going to turn those people away. I mean, eventually they're going to drop off, because the bulk of those people are older. And they will, I mean, just by attrition, they're just going to go away. So we have to be prepared to fill those coffers, you know, with donors who are willing to make more significant gifts. And frankly, the more, you know, if you ask for more, people usually give more. And if they don't want to give more, they'll give a little bit less. I think community radio, I think they're terrible fundraisers. I think that's been the case for a long time. And look, the other thing I will also say is that most public radio stations are terrible fundraisers. You know, there's not that much different between a small NPR or even a mid-sized NPR affiliate and a community radio station. They are, they have similar attitudes and conventions towards fundraising, which really prevents them from scaling up and making a greater community impact. Your capacity needs to drive your vision. And if you don't have the capacity, then, you know, then your vision is incredibly stunted.
And this is Eric. I wonder, I'm going to give you a window into my previous life at a radio station, and I want you to comment on it, because this is how I think of fundraising at a radio station. I worked at KPFA in Berkeley, and then I have a similar experience with other stations I've volunteered at. The fund drive is like a slog through hell, and it's so sad, and it's like you get on your knees and you just... You walk through a thicket. Is that something that is wrong with the fund drive model, or is it was it just me that I didn't like it? What I'm trying to say is, like, you said that radio stations are terrible at fundraising, and I'm wondering if there's an attitude adjustment towards the fund drive.
No, I don't think it's about attitude. To be honest with you, I think it has to do more with technology. I think it has to do with antiquated ideas about why we have these drives. I think it's volunteer focus. Oh, it's a time when we can all get together and we can all pitch in and pick up a shovel. That's not why you have a fund drive. You have a fund drive to raise money. One of the issues, I think, confronting all stations, I don't care if you're WNYC in New York or if you're KPFA in Berkeley, or if you're KBUT in Crested Butte, one of the things that every single station is having to deal with is that more people want to give monthly donors, and that affects cash flow. It also means that fewer phones are going to ring, and so the culture of our drives is going to have to change. And that's something that we're wrestling with at KDHX. That was something that I wrestled with as the membership director at Alaska Public Media. You know, we had, you know, 8 slots to fill for the phone bank volunteers, where I cut that down to 4. We didn't need those people. We quadrupled the number of sustainers at Alaska Public Media. They don't need to call in. So we have to change the way that we manage our drives. And we need to be more aggressive about having monthly donors. We need to convert those people. And that's the kind of thinking that I think is very difficult for a lot of community radio stations, because it requires us to think differently about how we do our work. And it also requires us to think about what investments we need to make in order to do both, because we're still going to get one-time contributions. But at KDHX, it's almost half and half. And we need to... we need to have the people power to manage that work, to manage the monthly donors, but then also to manage, you know, the renewals and everything else. And I think that's something that that a lot of stations haven't quite figured out yet, which is, how do we address, you know, the changing nature of our drives? I mean, and I wish I had a silver bullet to give you guys, but I'm wrestling with this too.
Of course. No, I understand, but I agree with you because I've seen the shift and I've been at stations as this shift has been happening. And in some ways it doesn't require more labor to make the shift. It just requires a different application of the labor, but often it's also a shift in the skills, right?
Correct. Absolutely.
Going from phone banking and, you know, constant on-air pitching to the ability to do that follow-up. And because in fact, for most stations, getting people to donate again is not too far away from this idea of a sustaining monthly giving. It just tends to be quarterly or annual, and it's lots of mail and lots of licking envelopes and shoving them out the door. But in some ways, the amount of effort is no more, at the very least.
Well, and it should be less. I mean, one of the things I would say, I said at Alaska Public Media, and this, like, I thought the radio program director, I thought I was going to have to get the defibrillator off the wall. I thought she was going to have a heart attack after I said this. My goal was so that the phones never rang. I wanted everyone on EFT. Mm. I never want to hear the phone ring ever again. Because that's not the reality that we live in. I just got an email from Powell's in your neck of the woods, Paul, you know, in Portland, Oregon. You know, hey, your credit card's expired. You know, put in your new credit card. Oh, well, I mean, I want to make sure when I buy from Powell's, it's all taken care of.
You're talking about a bookstore.
And I'm talking about a bookstore, you know, and an alternative, funky, cool bookstore at that.
Yes. An institution of a bookstore.
Yes.
Hey, Anne, what do you think? So the other thing that makes me think negative things about Fun Drive was this, here we are, we're a radio station, we're doing what we do best, it's a great life, but then we have to put the whole radio station on pause and stop creating good radio and threaten the listener. Now you have to listen to us beg, and if you don't pony up, you know, we're stuck. You don't get your radio station back. And that sort of, that never felt good. Is that still a necessary way to fundraise, though?
No. And the reason is because the more your station has monthly donors, the more sustainers you have at your station, the more they're going to feel alienated. And to bring it back to PRPD, they actually had a panel of, I think it was about 15 donors, real donors from different public radio stations. And we got to ask them questions. And they were sitting up there on the main stage. And about half of them were sustainers. And every single one of them said, I feel like you guys ignore me. I don't feel included in this. You tell me I'm valuable. I said, but I'm not feeling it. Because you're still doing your drives the same way. You're going to alienate those people. And we can't do that. And there are very simple things that you can do to make your monthly donors feel included, feel special, feel that their investment is worth it. And that includes changing the sound of your fund drive. Absolutely.
And is there any other takeaways from the PRPD that you think would be of use to community radio, or things that might have been aha moments for you, or at least made you go, huh?
You know, I have to say Current has a good synopsis of this as well. So people want to read about it. But Eric Newsom was here, and he used to be the vice president of programming at National Public Radio. And he was one of the, you know, the keynote or plenary speakers here at the conference. He's now working at Audible, you know, and like a lot of NPR folks, you know, has, you know, and Paul, you know, Chris Bannon, formerly of New York Public Radio. So, you know, he was here, and so he's now, you know, he's moved on, you know, into, audio.
To Midroll Media, where I work.
Right, where you work. Exactly. So you're very familiar with this shift. So Eric is part of that, is part of that cohort of people, you know, from big public radio who are making this move. And one of the things that he said, and I thought this was important, and it really resonated with me because it's something that I say to community stations, which is that I am not proposing adding work. What I am proposing is not additive to what you are currently doing. What I am proposing, and he specifically, one of the things that he specifically said was, I think it's a total dodge for stations to say that they don't have enough money to invest in local programming. He said, I will look at your program schedule. And he's talking to NPR stations. He's talking to NPR affiliates who shell out a lot of money for, you know, for national network programming. And he said, I will tell you the five shows to take off your schedule in 30 seconds. And you use that money for your programming fund to develop talent and to develop locally produced programming. I'll tell you what those shows are.
I hope Car Talk is one.
But it's in a similar vein. I think that's a takeaway that I share, which is and for community stations, what's analogous, it's not what we're spending our money on, you know, for national network programming, but what are we spending our time on? And our time is money.
Right.
So, you know, I wrote a blog post for you guys that you shared, why community radio stations don't need news directors. What could you do with that money if you weren't paying someone $35,000 a year to produce a daily live newscast? What would you do with that money if you were a station? Think about that. That's the kind of, and that's very analogous, I think, to what Eric was saying. So he just reinforced to me the importance of how do we spend our time? How do we reallocate our resources within our building? What are we paying people to do? Do we need to pay them to do it? Or do we need to pay someone else with a different skill set to do something? Those sorts of things. What do we need to invest in?
That's it's provocative. But I, to me, it sounds completely reasonable. And I think even if with regard to a news director, not so much as what would you do with that salary, but what else could that news director do that would perhaps enhance a station's public service
right.
in a lot of ways, different than that live half-hour daily newscast? Because I think there's a lot of ways that stations can go about doing really great public service programming that really super serves their communities. And we talked to KRCL on our last show, which is doing it by producing, helping community members produce podcasts at their station, which get aired, but not as full podcasts, but as snippets throughout their music programming, as another way of how to integrate public affairs and community service and that kind of community access while also providing a service, because full podcasts get produced out of the station. So I think there's a lot of ways stations can go about that.
That's a perfect – I love that example, Paul. That's a perfect example of how a station is thinking about how it's thinking non-traditionally about how to allocate its resources. I'm glad that you brought that up, because I've been following that as well.
And thank you so much for sharing some of both your experience and your wisdom there from the Public Radio Program Directors Conference in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Eric.
So I really enjoyed hearing from Anne right there in the room at the conference, but she threw a bomb, Paul. And
well, she threw it on radiosurvivor.com first, months ago, just right. to be fair.
So I didn't do my homework. She threw this bomb at the news director position, and I just need to say that in my limited experience at radio stations, the news director at KPFA in specifics was the one professional who had a paid job at the station, who I looked up to, who I admired, who provided me with volunteer training that is invaluable still. This Radio Survivor radio show podcast that we make would not be what it is without some of those skills that I learned from those news directors. So I needed to defend them. I think I can understand that she's not talking about those people.
She's not talking about, yes. I think, you know, if I were to make a friendly amendment, so to speak, to Anne's point, which in spirit I completely agree with, it is that what could that time be used for? And I think I said that in the interview. What could that time that is often used to put together a newscast which is rough around the edges and may or may not be listened to in many cases, or is sort of stands out in the broadcast day because it doesn't quite match up with the other programming around it. How could you provide equivalent or better service with that person's time and expertise? How right. could you do news and journalism that's vital to the community and covering issues that aren't getting covered elsewhere, especially on the radio? How could you do that with that and use these news directors' great passion, skill, and effort to do that in a different way? I think that's the question that I bring to it. And then if you're a station that wishes you had a news director, because I think if you go back and read Anne's piece, and we'll put it in the show notes, radiosurvivor.com/podcast. I think she's aiming a lot of it at stations that wish they had a news director, because it is not the case that every community station has a news director. It tends to be stations that serve communities above a certain size. There are lots of community stations that do not have any paid programmers at all and don't have paid news directors. But a lot of them wish they did. It's often on their wish list. And I think that it's those stations that we're really speaking to in a lot of ways, especially all these low-power FMs coming on the air.
Or the small NPR affiliate.
Or the small NPR affiliate, right, is, you know, how could you still do amazing community service but not have to just slit it into this paradigm that's not necessarily a bad paradigm but isn't universal and in many cases doesn't work really well. Depends on the station, of course. So, again, not calling out anyone or any particular station, but that, you know, and this is the thing that I think about for community radio in general. There's so many things done at so many stations that are done that way because that's the way you do them, right? And change is hard, and I understand that. But there isn't always evidence that the objectives and goals are being reached. And I was a fan of, in every station I've been at, of asking, let's go back to basics here. What's our mission and how is this serving our mission? Right. If there was a street festival at a station I was at, we had it every year. And, you know, in some years it was amazing and people turned out, and other years it was sort of pathetic.
Yeah.
You know, and it seemed kind of threadbare and people showed up and it was sort of a good time, but a whole lot of effort went into that street fair every damn year. And every damn year it also seemed like it didn't really come together till the last minute. And so there's a lot of scrambling and a lot of people putting in, you know, a lot of last minute time and not getting a lot of sleep and really running themselves ragged to pull it off. And I said, why do we do this? Well, but I would feel so bad if we didn't do this year. But why would it feel bad? Doesn't it feel bad when we do it and maybe, like, you know, 75 people show up over the course of 8 hours, you know, and we put this money into it and we don't seem to make any money out of it? And I think this is true for news departments. Right. This is true for music departments. It's true for those shows that have been on for a long time and seem to be well-worn. It's the reason why all these mid-sized NPR and small-sized NPR stations still run freaking Car Talk, right? Voice of the dead.
Car Talk makes them money too, right? And aren't they kind of stuck? But
they don't question that. Right. They don't sit there and go, well, how much money does it make? Because Car Talk costs an awful lot to get. Even now that it's the voices of the dead, Car Talk costs a lot of money for them to get. And so are they asking the question of how much would we save if we canceled Car Talk?
I love thinking about Car Talk still airing 20 years from now when it's about antique cars that don't have cars that we had to drive ourselves back before.
Remember those cars that ran on gasoline?
Yeah, and then we still listen to it because people love those laughs. This is a founding question. This is a founding theme of Radio Survivor, isn't it? There's a long list of ways that radio stations run themselves. And there might be some of those things that should be crossed off the list. It's an open question as to what needs to be crossed
Try
off.
Try something new. And in a lesson, what I want to always make sure we're saying is that, so you're a new low-power FM station or a newer community station, and so you're thinking of what to do. Take this moment to try something different, to take a new tack, to take a new opportunity, and not feel like, oh, we have to do a half hour news program, live news program every day because that's what community radio stations do. Maybe that's the right thing for your city or town. I'm not telling you shouldn't do it, but interrogate that and think about, could we do 5 solid minutes every day? 5 really solid, tight minutes that sounds good, you can put up on your website for people to stream or podcast at any point, and that can be inserted several times every day. So you don't even – it's not just the people who tune in at 5 or 6 o'clock that get the news, but people who tune in at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and 7 o'clock in the evening who also get that 5 solid minutes of news that isn't just the same headlines that's in the local paper or the same headlines that's sort of on the regional news site, but that is some original reporting that you're able to do. But it's just 5 minutes.
Right.
Just think about all these different ways. That's what I hope we're doing here is to try and think of new ways of doing it. Or whether you take a page out of KRCL's book and you invite people in to do podcasts. And so you get – it's not quite news, but it's definitely community and public affairs programming. And now you have 3 minutes or 5 minutes that you can insert throughout the day that doesn't take people – too far outside of the normal programming they're used to hearing and maybe brings them something different and arguably maybe exposes new and different listeners to news and community programming rather than just the folks who specifically tune in to hear a half hour of news or who stumble into a half hour of news and for whatever reason don't change the station. Sorry, I got off on a rant.
It's okay. Today's the day for ranting. If people were curious what you're talking about, we interviewed Laura Jones of the Utah community radio station.
Salt Lake City.
And the call letters are escaping.
KRCL,
and that was on episode 17. So you could check that out if you don't know what Paul's talking about.
Because that
was a really interesting new model of community podcasting at a radio station.
And you know, what do you think? Listener, we're talking to you. What do you think about this idea, that maybe stations don't need news directors or they should find new ways to fundraise? And maybe in some of the points that Ann brought up about providing exclusive experiences for some of your members who are able to give more than the $10 a month or are able to give more than the $40 a year. Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Send us your comments to podcast@radiosurvivor.com. Please let us know if we can read your comments on the air. Even better, record us something. You can just use the voice memo app on your smartphone, talking to your computer. If you want to do it with us over Skype, just let us know and we'll find the time to record that with you. And we'd love to share your thoughts in your own voice. We want this to be a conversation as much as possible. You know, we know that we don't want to talk at you. We'd like to talk with you. So please just send us that email, podcast@radiosurvivor.com.
Next up on the program, we have College Radio Watch with Jennifer Waits.
So this week, Jennifer, you have two college radio stories for us. The first is about an event that is coming up just around the corner.
Yeah, I think October is sort of college radio month. And CBI, which is College Broadcasters Inc., they have their annual convention in Minneapolis this year, and it's October 22nd to 24th. They call it the CBI National Student Electronic Media Convention. So it's all inclusive. It's not just college radio. It's high school students who are involved with student media can come. People involved with television stations, websites. So all encompassing. But there's definitely quite a bit of college radio stuff going on at the conference. So they've got panels and workshops, an annual swag swap, which is pretty fun, where you can bring a bunch of stuff from your station, like t-shirts and stickers, throw them on a table, and then people walk around a room and try to grab all of the choice goodies that people have brought. And it's also a chance to see what other stations do as far as promotional items. And the CBI conference concludes with an awards ceremony. Every year they give out the National Student Production Awards. And in this case, they are highlighting some of the best student video and audio production that took place during the course of the year. All of the sessions are now posted on the CBI website, which is askcbi.org. And I should also note that I'm going to be there at CBI. So I will be doing a presentation that is largely talking about my college radio touring around the country. And so I'll share highlights from college radio tours. And I will also be leading a panel discussion about college radio history, which I'm super excited about. Mike Lupica from with the Princeton radio station, WPRB. He's going to be joining me for that, and he's going to talk a lot about what he has done as far as putting together a college radio history website at Princeton, and then an exhibit that now is ongoing at Princeton about the history of the radio station. So I'm super excited about that, and hopefully we will help inspire more college radio stations to document their history.
Yeah, it sounds like you'll have two very interesting presentations at the CBI conference this year, and the whole conference. Looks like it'll be great. Next, you have some follow-up on a story you've been covering for years, now with what is probably the final big piece of news.
So we're talking about KUSF, which was the college radio station at University of San Francisco, formerly at 90.3 FM. And back in 2011, all of a sudden, without notice, the station was shut down in the middle of a DJ show. And it turned out that the administration at University of San Francisco had entered into a secret deal to sell the license to another group called Classical Public Radio Network, which planned to run classical programming by utilizing an existing commercial radio station in San Francisco called KDFC. So they ended up buying the branding for that station and then turning it non-commercial and using the former KUSF license for that. It's very complicated, very controversial. KUSF was a well-loved, long-standing college radio station. And so people were quite upset about this sudden shutdown and started fighting the sale immediately. It took a year for the sale to go through, but in the process, there were a lot of complaints filed with the FCC, legal filings, and in the course of that, the groups fighting the sale ended up attracting the FCC's attention, and the FCC started its own investigation into the deal and actually found that there were some problems with it because the group that was buying the license, Classical Public Radio Network, before the sale went through, they were paying University of San Francisco a substantial bit of money for airtime, which was more than typical expenses that you would incur running a station. So USF was profiting from them paying for airtime, and that, as it turns out, is in violation of FCC rules. So because of the investigation and because of people complaining about it, the FCC ended up entering into a consent decree with University of San Francisco and Classical Public Radio Network, and there was a fine of $50,000. But despite that, the license sale still went through. So the people fighting the sale continued to fight the sale even after the sale went through. So they filed petitions to deny, applications for review, and the reason we're talking about it 4 years later is that some lingering applications for review were just dismissed by the FCC. And the applications for review were looking at some of the same issues that were brought up during the FCC investigation of the license sale, having to do with things like third-party fundraising over the air, having to do with it giving up control of the station, so main studio rule violations. And so friends of KUSF and another individual KUSF listener, they were bringing up that some of these issues, they did not feel like they were fully addressed by the FCC in their earlier rulings. And so they were asking them to take another look. And the FCC did, and they didn't find any new violations. So they dismissed the applications for review.
So if I understand correctly, with the first action by the FCC that ended up in a fine for USF and the Classical Radio Network, the finding is that the university should not have been receiving any money above and beyond the actual cost to operate the KUSF transmitter during that time that the station was broadcasting classical radio programming from CRN, but before CRN actually acquired the license. The operating principle there is that a non-commercial licensee like University of San Francisco cannot lease out its signal for a profit. Then, for the second round of filings made against USF and CRN, which the FCC just decided, a claim was made that it was improper for the Classical Radio Network to fundraise on the KUSF signal while the license was still owned by the university. But the FCC found that there was no violation of policy or the law in that case. And another complaint against USF alleged that during that same period, the university didn't have an adequate ability to originate a broadcast at the station, which the complainants say is another violation of FCC rules. And again, the commission disagreed, correct?
Yeah. So, you know, if you own the license, you have to maintain control of the studio. So that was the crux of that. And the KUSF studio was torn down. I visited and saw the lack of the studio. But the university claimed that they still could originate broadcasts from University of San Francisco. And so, yeah, so in this latest ruling, the FCC concluded that the parties petitioning them had failed to demonstrate that the Bureau had erred, and they found no substantial and material question of fact concerning statutory or rule violations. FCC also points out that they had already entered this consent decree, and they feel that that addressed the violations that had occurred.
So, in a way, the Friends of KUSF demonstrated that by being vigilant and exercising their right to petition the FCC, they were able to complicate things for both the University of San Francisco and the Classical Radio Network, even if they were not successful in all counts. Both USF and CRN certainly had to expend additional, perhaps unexpected, resources to defend themselves in front of the FCC.
Oh, yeah. They definitely made it hard on them. And Friends of KUSF, who filed one of these applications for review, they issued a statement and they said, "While we're not surprised at this ruling, it's still very disappointing and disheartening. We will continue to explore other legal options and continue to fight for true community and independent media in San Francisco."
Thanks, Jennifer, for continuing to follow this story all these years and keeping us all up to date on these kinds of stories that would otherwise get forgotten.
Definitely.
Well, that's bittersweet because KUSF was a wonderful station that I had experience with as a Bay Area resident and as a Bay Area radio nerd. And I want to tell a story that I learned from a DVD commentary. Oh, here's a fun thing I want to say first, though. I figured out last week, that the reason I like DVD commentaries is because they're radio.
Yeah.
And they've gone out of style because people aren't buying the DVDs like they used to. And yet there's this wonderful backstop. There's the podcasts where people who would have recorded DVD commentaries in the past, like I've just uncovered the existence of the Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul podcasts, which are not fan generated content. They are, you know, an editor on the show.
Oh, okay.
Interviews writing staff and acting staff about each episode. And
cool.
So it's basically a podcast length DVD commentary, unattached and unencumbered and free to the listener. So I thought that was neat. So
can I tell you my favorite DVD? This is very
yes.
fast. My favorite DVD commentary is actually one that started out on Laserdisc, which mm-hmm. was the first format to have the commentary tracks. And this is for the Laserdisc of the Kevin Smith film mm-hmm. Chasing Amy. And he starts the commentary.
Kevin Smith, a very talented podcaster.
Yeah, also a very talented podcaster. He starts – he actually says he's probably a better podcaster than he is director. He starts it off with this. Well, before I get started, let me just say one thing. FDVD. At the time, there was a format war, and DVD was the new kid on the block, and Laserdisc was the – we all know how that turned out.
Yeah, that's funny.
Words now forever emblazoned in laser written.
Staked
pits.
A very nerdy claim on a big, huge loser
on a commentary track.
So I'm watching a DVD commentary track on a documentary on the Weathermen, and in the DVD commentary track, the director gives a nod to KUSF, and he explains how he's a listener and a big fan, and one day. In his studio or in his studio apartment, he was listening and he heard music that he really connected with. And here's one of the things I love about radio stations. You can call them and say, "Who am I hearing?" And, you know,
at least you can a community radio station.
Yeah, and at KUSF, they love to get those phone calls, or they used to. And that's probably what he did. And he found out the name of that artist, and that's the artist that he then contacted to create the score for his documentary.
Oh, wow. What's the name of that documentary?
That documentary was called The Weather Underground, and I thought that was just a very unique nod to community radio, that the experience that he was having listening to KUSF connected him with the local composer that he then hired to help him make his documentary.
And next, we're going to hear from our own Matthew Lessar with Lessar's Letter on Radio.
Come on in, the music's free, yours musically, WABC.
This is Lessar's Letter on Radio History, and today's question is, did disco destroy this radio station?
WABC, the American Network.
You are listening to a historic air check of WABC Music Radio, the greatest top 40 music radio station of all time, or at least that's what some folks say, and who am I to challenge the subjectivities?
Exciting music. Keep listening to WABC in New York, Channel 77.
In its heyday in the 1960s, WABC Top 40 enjoyed a huge on-air presence. It could be heard 100 miles from New York City during the day. Because it was an AM signal, WABC also reached most of the eastern United States and Canada at night. But in 1978, a neighboring FM station adopted an all-disco format, almost instantly gobbling up at least 25% of WABC's share. Was disco the culprit that killed WABC? Interestingly, in an interview years later, the station's program director, Rick Sklar, said no.
What was going on was a change in technology. The same thing that originally made radio what it was. The radio is a creature of technology. When TV came along, a new technology, radio had to change. Conversely, when FM came along, and the government said FM has to have separate programming from AM, you can't duplicate. Another technology came along, and this one was capable of presenting music in a far better way, in that it was in stereo, and you could get higher frequencies, you could pick them up, the receivers were of greater quality, and you didn't have the interference and the squeal and the static and the hum associated with AM radios. So there was a new and better way of presenting music.
To be specific about that Federal Communications Commission decision, in 1965, the FCC ruled that AM stations could not duplicate their programming on a co-owned FM station for more than half the broadcast day, at least for FM stations in big markets.
So eventually, music would move over, and that's what really happened. Now, the fact that the year that the majority of the music audience shifted to FM, disco happened to be in vogue, was simply a coincidence. It could have been anything. Whatever music was in vogue the year that the technology shift took place, that would be prominent in people's heads as to what finally superseded a WABC.
Still, Sklar points out that WABC was a unique phenomenon in the history of broadcasting.
But look, when WABC was up there, it was up there with 15, 20, 25 shares of the market. These little pipsqueaks that call themselves number one today with a 5 or 6 share, that's nothing. They're all chipping away little bits. One guy's got a 7.6, another a 7.3, and then a big deal. It's simply a fractionalized FM dial with a lot of people playing music. But disco didn't do WABC in. It was FM technology.
I tend to think that the disco killed WABC thesis was fueled at least in part by the huge anti-disco backlash among rock and pop fans in the late 1970s. In reality, this was an example of the huge difference that a government regulation calling for more media diversity made on broadcast radio. This is Matthew Lessar noting that the moment is quite relevant as the FCC considers rules to revitalize AM radio today.
Man, I remember WABC. So, you know, I grew up in Toms River, New Jersey, which is about 70 miles south of Manhattan as the crow flies. Down at the Jersey Shore, just inland from Seaside Heights, made famous by the show Jersey Shore. Where I'll note nobody was from the Jersey Shore there. And as a kid, I used
Is that regional pride?
That is regional pride, by the way.
Good to know. Well noted.
Well, you know, it used to be, if I mentioned Toms River, Seaside Heights, if you weren't kind of from New Jersey or the New York area, no one had ever heard of it. But now everyone's heard of it, so I need the disclaimer. And I think I've mentioned this before anyway, but I used to listen to WABC as a kid. I had like a little AM transistor radio the size of what would become a Walkman, but I was probably 7 or 8, so it's like late 70s, early 80s. And yeah, they played pop music, right? It had this sort of big booming echoey DJs, and you'd hear both sort of kind of at that time would have been classic hits like, you know, the Beach Boys, as well as some more modern, at that time, contemporary pop hits. And I really liked it. It sounded very urban and authoritative and exciting. And of course, this is the time when the DJs would talk over the song until the very moment in which the vocal happened. And as soon as the vocal ended, they talk over the end of the song and into the next song. And it was nary, you know, there's no air in there. It was just all, you know, there's the Beach Boy, and then the song starts and it comes in. And I remember the disco debate, of course, as well, probably as a kid in the third or fourth grade, where one had to take a position. Did disco suck or did it not? I remember hearing this debate about did it kill WABC later on, mm-hmm. As an adult. And like Matthew, I tend to think it's sort of it's more about two things which overlap than it is about the fact that this particular genre. Because I can remember myself by the time a couple of years later, by the time I would have been maybe 10, 11 years old, I was listening to FM radio because that's where the music was. And it was no longer on AM radio. I think even by then, WABC had turned into a talk radio station. Its competitor, WNBC, which no longer exists, where Howard Stern and Don Imus got their start, also turned in basically into talk radio in about the same time frame. And I listened to very little AM radio after that because I wanted all the music, which it was a lot harder to get the music stations from New York in Toms River at 70 miles away. You had to kind of work really hard with the antenna and be willing to kind of hang it out the window at times to get it in.
Yeah, but that's an image that you've painted on this podcast before. A young Paul leaning out the window to try to hear things.
I lived in the place that wasn't too close to any metro center, just far enough away so that everything was difficult to get in, except for the local stations.
When we're done with the orange microphone, and we can hire an artist. I would like to hire someone to draw a picture of the 8-year-old Paul Rees-Mandel leaning out his window with his radio antenna so he could hear more of the metal.
Yes, so that was WSOU. Metal. Yes, indeed. So that's just my opportunity to share. I think I've shared enough, though, on this show. So we hope you'll share with us. Go on over to our Patreon page and maybe throw us a few shekels every month. We'd really appreciate it. You heard Ann Alkist earlier talking about how the trend is towards having sustaining funders, people who give monthly amounts to radio stations. We'd hope maybe you'll give a monthly amount to this podcast to help us keep doing what it is we're doing. As little as $1 a month would help a lot. And of course, if you can go all the way up to $10 a month, that'll help even more. Go to patreon.com/radiosurvivor. We also want to hear from you. Send us an email to podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And if you use iTunes at all, we'd really appreciate it if you'd subscribe there so it gets counted, because still iTunes pretty much has the cornered the market on charts and ranking.
iTunes-wise, we had the Radio Survivor podcast had a very nice presence on iTunes at the very beginning, and we've dropped off the iTunes radar for what it's worth. And so if you're listening to the sound of our voices and you want to help us out, help us get back on their radar and go subscribe and rate.
In rate, yeah, click. I think because it was the new and noteworthy section.
We were new and noteworthy.
And so we're not new anymore. So now we can just hope to be noteworthy. And maybe you all can help us do that. We really appreciate it. And of course, if whatever you'd like us to do, something you think we should cover, someone or some station or some project you think deserves more attention, we'd love to hear about it. Send it to us, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. Any last thoughts or words, Eric?
Gosh, about podcasting and radio? I think I've expressed myself today.
I've more than expressed myself. Thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, it's been fun.